Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Quiet Cadence, a novel by Mark Trainor. Narrated by Andrew B. Whirlin. 1. Sometimes the ghosts talk to me still. 40 years ago, they came frequently. In my 30s and 40s and 50s, not very much. They've visited some in recent years, and mostly that's okay. The dream frightened me for a long time. I couldn't tell if my old friends accused me or wished me well. Sometimes they seemed to look to me for answers I've never had. I searched for a long time for a way to make peace with them and what I'd lost. My best friend and my wife helped me with that. Corey lost a great deal more than I did in Vietnam, at least physically, yet helped me remember what was good. Patty lived with much of what I brought home and saved me more than once from the dark. I've spoken very little of my war and the turmoil that followed, and over the years, nearly no one has asked. Most men my age celebrate Woodstock and hate Ashbury, reminisce about sit-ins on campuses or protests in the streets. They still marvel at their luck in the draft, or, depending on their audience, boast of or bury the deferments they received. My decile of the 60s generation grows old, having said little to our children about times very different for us. Recently, though, even us old guys sometimes hear, "Thanks for your service." Sort of faint echoes of the well-deserved cheers greeting our troops coming home from our most recent wars. My guess is they'll find it difficult, too, to grapple with the truths they've learned. We have more in common than they may know. I'd like my kids to understand the events that changed their old man forever when I wasn't much older than theirs are now. Sometimes I think they believe my memories of those charged days were surgically removed along with the bullet in my back. Not that I blame them. I haven't exactly encouraged questions about my war or its impact on me. But I remember it all. A gift and a curse. Remembrance across decades is like looking through a telescope. Sometimes people and events in the distance come into the sharpest focus of all. The pictures come to me in extraordinary detail, like photos my brain took but couldn't erase. Sometimes frayed at the edges with things in the middle I wish I'd never seen, though there are some photos I would not want to lose. I remember the odors, the heat and the wet, the exhaustion and fear. I can still taste the bite of gunpowder, the terrible ferric sweetness of blood. I can still hear the cacophonous noises, the voices, the argot, the silences. It's as though they're next to my ear. What a profane crass gang we were. I remember the pain and the joy when I returned to the world, the hopes and the nightmares, the shame of what I did to get my first job. The one I'll retire from soon. I remember the love. My family and friends know me as a man whose most violent moments generated fast tennis serves. How do I explain that when I was very young, I plumbed the depths of depravity without knowing if I'd find my way back to sanity's surface? I can describe the camaraderie of shared misery, but can I also relate the excitement, the pride, and the love without downplaying the horror and terror that nearly drove me mad? What about the craziness in the years after the war? Patty thinks it's important that I tell the truth. She knows a little of my story, but she's probably right. She's usually been. I think it's time I tried. I know that too many men grow old, basking in selective memories of their youth. But I don't believe much in glory, though I wouldn't trade anything for my time in the Corps. Unless it was to save the forever young men who march front and center in my sleep. That dream always begins in silence, an absolute vacuum of noise. Then, only a faint, distant sound, the whoop, whoop, and thrum of an approaching medevac bird. Quivering in the air, a muted tremor of cries. A shroud of gunpowder-infused fog covers all. Then my old friends emerge from the swirling pall and walk toward me, their eyes never leaving my face. They step to a cadence I sometimes strain to hear. Lately, Pious John's spoken for all six of them. "Tell them now, Mick," he says. "Tell them the truth." This, then, is their story, and mine. It begins on the day I saw the dead man above the trees. 2. The helicopter roared and squealed and shook as it flew. The ceiling of the CH-46 was open, a tangle of black wires and dull aluminum tubes glistening with a lubricious sheen. The chopper smelled of JP-5 and hydraulic fluid and gunpowder. Brown splotches spread across the metal floor like the aftermath of a toxic spill. It was good that I didn't know then that blood stains metal. Every time we lurched, I grabbed the web seat I sat on, convinced we were falling out of the sky. The door gunners leaned over their mounted 50 cals and studied the rumpled patchwork quilt of rice paddies, tree lines, and hillocks unfolding fast below us. I wondered if they'd be able to spot anyone firing at us, certain that hordes of bloodthirsty, wiry brown men glared up at us with slanted, fanatical eyes. I wondered whether a bullet could penetrate the helicopter's floor. 4 of us were headed to the bush. Havy, Timmons, and I were new guys, in Vietnam 5 days, all of it behind wire. Lance Corporal Woodson was on his way back out to Bravo Company after R&R. None of us would complete a full 13-month tour. Waiting on the airstrip, Woodson had tried to smile at us new guys. It looked like the effort made his face hurt. Even ragingly hungover, he was strikingly handsome. If it weren't for his faded uniform and beat-up gear, I might have guessed he was a movie star, part of a USO tour visiting the base for a few hours. "How you doing?" I said. Woody nodded very slowly, as though movement might cause a disaster inside his skull. "Wonderful." He tried again to smile, but all he produced were some crooked wrinkles around his lips and eyes. "Long as you've got your health," he said quietly. His eyes smiled at that. It didn't make sense to me, but I didn't ask. I wondered if the crate of mortar rounds he sat on could explode. If we got rocketed, there wouldn't be enough left of him to fill a C-ration box. But then, I thought, standing beside him, if those rounds go up, there won't be enough left of me to make a bad impression. "Welcome to war," I congratulated myself in an attempt to calm my nerves. Just like John Wayne or Gregory Peck, the stalwart who doesn't blink in the face of possible death. It's amazing how foolish you can be when you're 19. Havy was a black kid from Mississippi with a cherubic face and ears like ginger snaps glued to his head. He talked in such a falsetto, if you looked away, you might imagine you were talking with a 12-year-old girl. He was a nice guy, but I didn't trust him. He wanted to do the right thing, but struggled to do about anything right. That could get someone else killed. His mother talked him into enlisting, signed the papers with him since he wasn't 18. She thought after the Marines, he wouldn't get picked on so much. I've wondered if she ever forgave herself. Timmons was the sort who could be all by himself in a soundproof room and still piss somebody off. He thought he was a tough guy, too cool to have much to do with another boot like me, though I was squared away, and we were both PFCs. He joined the Marines because his girlfriend's old man had won the Navy Cross on Guadalcanal and owned a construction company now. Timmons planned to go home a hero, impress the father, marry the daughter, and take over the business. His attitude made me as nervous as Havy's ineptitude. A guy aiming to be a hero could get people around him killed. Given what he did after we went to the valley, I'm pretty sure Timmons' plans didn't work out. The three of us had been sent together to Bravo Company's headquarters tent when we first got to Hoa Binh. First Sergeant Miller and his clerk were the only people who worked at the field desks under the baked canvas. The rest of the company was out in the bush. They were always out in the bush. In front of the tent, a large wooden sign painted scarlet with a gold Marine Corps eagle, globe, and anchor stenciled in each corner said, "Bush Bravo, we count the meat." "Welcome to Bravo Company, men," Top Miller greeted us. His salt-and-pepper flat top and deeply lined cheeks gave him a hard, no-nonsense look, but his eyes were kind. I thought of him at the time as a pretty old man. He was probably 37 or 38. The top was a few months into his second tour in his second war. "You're joining the best rifle company in the Marine Corps. You've got a lot to live up to." He looked us each in the eye. "I'm sure you will. I hoped he was right. But how could I know until I'd actually seen the combat? The clerk, a short-timer rifleman named Landau, who stayed in the rear to help with paperwork after he got out of the hospital, didn't look up. A scar ran from his temple to his chin. He kept raising his hands high as he pecked two long, thin fingers at his typewriter keys. First Sergeant Miller said Landau would get us checked in. The top smiled, actually looked pleased to have us with him. "I'll see you men again before you go to the bush," he said. "Right now the company is in a pretty easy area. We haven't gotten any kills there, but haven't taken any casualties either. That could change. It's going to be hotter than a freshly fucked fox in a forest fire today, so drink lots of water. Welcome aboard." After the top left, Havy said, "I wondered about the sign outside. What's it mean?" Landau stopped typing, gave a single cock of his head as if to say, "Damnedest thing I ever heard." He seemed to measure Havy, then looked at Timmins and me to see if we were screwing with him. I was pretty certain I understood the sign, but wasn't going to say anything. Timmins looked back at Landau with a grimace that mocked Havy and his naivete. Landau apparently concluded that the new guy wasn't pulling his leg. "Body count," he said. "When Bravo finishes with the gooks, all that's left is dead meat. You'll see soon enough." Havy's eyes looked like fried eggs gone bad in the middle. Timmins rolled his eyes and pooched out his lips as though the answer had been intuitively obvious. I didn't say anything. It was silent in the tent for a couple minutes, except for the clack of Landau's poking at the typewriter like a convulsive pianist. When he looked up, the sudden movement of his scarred face was like a light beam slashing through the tent. I wondered if I'd have scars like his before I was through. "You're all going to 1st Platoon," he said, "the gungiest platoon in the company. Dinky Dow, crazy, the whole bunch. McClure, you're going to be Lance Corporal Garofano's assistant gunner. He's the gungiest of them all." Landau shook his head as though amazed. "Loves to hunt gooks. Damn near died when he was wounded. Still couldn't wait to get back to the bush." He added as though to assure me, "When the shit hits the fan, you'll be happy to have Garofano beside you." Havy looked like he wasn't understanding half of what Landau said. Timmins grinned. "In fact," Landau looked at all three of us, "when you guys go to the valley, you'll be damn lucky it's 1st Platoon you're with." "Are we going for sure?" Timmins sounded like he couldn't wait. We'd already heard stories. Crawling with NVA. Booby traps all over the place. Timmins gonna be a hero and a construction tycoon. "Top thinks so," Landau said. "Probably a few weeks from now," he grinned. "My ass will have Sky at home by then." "Garofano's last day gonna rotate home recently?" I asked. Lando looked at me like I'd sprouted a gargoyle on my neck. "He was killed last week." Lieutenant Mangan sat in the dirt writing a letter. He had holes in his green t-shirt and a rip in one knee of his trousers. "Welcome back, Woody," he said. Whitson looked like someone was performing a root canal through the top of his skull. "Swell to be back, Lieutenant." "Let's hope we don't get hit tonight. Looks like your head might explode." Woody nodded slowly, as if moving faster might set something off between his ears. The lieutenant put his riding gear in a plastic bag, then stood up. "Who's the 0331? "I am, sir," I said. "PFC McClure." Mangan looked at me for a moment, sizing me up. He was 22 or 23, but I thought of him as older. Probably because he was an officer and I was a 19-year-old PFC. Probably, too, because his eyes conveyed a hard wariness that seemed much older than the rest of his sparsely stubbled face. "Good," he said. "We can use you." He turned to Havy and Timmins. "You're both going to 1st Squad. I'll introduce you to Corporal Harding." He looked at Woody and pointed. "Landon's hole's over there." He smiled a little then. "You can get there on your own." "Sober as a judge, Lieutenant." "You must have some bad judges in Delaware." We walked behind where 1st Platoon was dug in along a third of the company's perimeter. Beyond the hill, paddies crisscrossed by dikes and bordered by tree lines seemed to stretch on forever. The hilltop itself was a raw, muddy moonscape, studded by torn boulders and pocked by deep fighting holes and shallow, straddled trenches. It wasn't yet 8 a.m., but it had to be in the 90s, mist rose in ghostly vapors from the baking mud. Down the hill, shredded shards of trees groped skyward, like the wretches in despair, on the cover of the Dante's Inferno I was supposed to read during my freshman semester at UVA. In the thick, wet air, I could smell napalm-charred wood. I wondered what the top really meant by an easy area. The lieutenant asked where we were from. When I said Towson, just outside Baltimore, he said, "Ever eat at Hausner's?" I did a couple times when I was at Annapolis. "Great chow." "Yes, sir. Amazing desserts." I thought of asking if he'd made it to any Orioles or Colts games when he was at Navy, but he didn't really seem interested in small talk. Corporal Harding shook hands with each of us, but didn't smile, until the lieutenant asked, "How's your wife doing?" Harding broke into a wide grin then. "Great, Lieutenant." He scratched at a fester of gook sores on his arm below a brightly colored eagle globe and anchor tattoo. The sores looked like leprosy to me. "Not long now."
"Just a few weeks, sir. I'm betting he's a boy."
"Any new pictures?" Corporal Harding glanced at the three of us. He grinned again at the lieutenant.
"Not in her condition, sir. Not that I'm sharing any more."
I found out later his wife used to send him Polaroid nudies of herself. She had an EGA tattoo like his, too.
"Don't blame me for that." The lieutenant's smile faded. "I'll leave you with your new people," he pointed. "Havy and Timmons, right?"
"Yes, sir," Havy said.
Corporal Harding cocked his head like a Doberman trying to figure out where the squeak came from in a new toy.
"Right, Lieutenant," Timmons said.
Harding pivoted toward him.
"That's yes, sir, Lieutenant. Got it, Marine?"
I half expected him to get right up in Timmons' face. I wondered if he'd been a DI before Vietnam.
"Yes, sir."
Timmons didn't sound like he was trying to be cool then.
"Let's go, McClure. Find the Pope."
I had no idea what the lieutenant meant by that, but I wasn't about to ask. We approached a fighting hole, where a thick-set, muscular Marine sat in the mud on a tattered piece of cardboard, an M60 machine gun beside him. He had a stubble of dark hair, a couple days' heavy growth of beard, and a thick, drooping mustache. He wore only scarred, filthy boots and faded tiger-striped shorts. Dog tags, a rosary, and a crusty green towel hung around his neck. He was sunburned a deep bronze, except for the pink scar ropes crisscrossing his chest like ritual markings on an Aborigine warrior. He was watching a can of Franks and beans bubble over a flaming chunk of plastic explosive. My God, I thought. Garofano even looks like a barbarian. What the hell am I in for now?
"Hey, Pope," the lieutenant called.
Garofano looked up and smiled. His eyes looked genuinely happy.
"Hey, Lieutenant. Sorry for not standing. Can't knock over the feast."
He pointed to the steaming can. Lieutenant Mangan waved off the comment.
"Lance Corporal Garofano, meet PFC McClure, your new A-gunner."
Garofano reached up a sinewy, thick arm encrusted with runny sores and swallowed my hand in his.
"Welcome to Shit City," he said with a grin.
3. Pius John Garofano was his real name. "My mom named me after a couple of popes. I come from a pretty religious family," he said with a look that indicated he might be telling an inside joke. "When my dad had cancer my senior year in high school, I promised God that if he'd cure him, I'd become a priest. Prayed my ass off. Didn't work worth a damn. But I entered the seminary anyway. Lasted a year. Then joined the Marines." John grinned like he'd played a pretty funny joke on himself. He wiped the crusty green towel over his head and chest. The rosary around his neck caught in the threads. John untangled the beads and looked at the crucifix.
"Who knows? Things change. I could go back."
"Did you know Ignatius of Loyola was one hard-ass officer in the Spanish army before he became a priest and founded the Jesuits?"
"I didn't."
John grinned again. He had terrible breath.
"The Corps and the Jebbies have a lot in common. Self-sacrifice, service to the downtrodden and oppressed."
He looked out over the rice paddies beyond the hill.
"Lots of those around here."
He absently rubbed his fingertips across the raised scars on his chest, like strumming a ukulele. I'd half expected a wild-eyed killer. He sounded more like a social worker. Even now, all these years later, despite what we did in the valley, I think he might have been a fine priest, or anything else that involved sacrificing for other people. We turned two ammunition cans upside down on a sleeve of C-ration cardboard and put the machine gun in front of us on another piece, then sat in the broiling sun, talking and cleaning the gun. John's clothing and boots and gear were faded and worn. I looked like I'd bought up every new sale item in an Army-Navy surplus store. I envied his dark Italian skin. I had the Irish McClure clan complexion, arms a boiled lobster red, and my face a texture of a deeply embarrassed birch tree. John had been in country 4.5 months, counting the 4 weeks he spent in Japan recuperating from wounds. He was inspecting the bolt and operating rod when he asked if I'd brought a toothbrush.
Sure, I said. Two?
Just one.
That'll do.
He looked as though we were about to unwrap a birthday present. Man, that's great. I had two, but lost the one I used on the gun a few days ago, so the teeth lost out again. We can share yours until more come in a supply pack. Under the ammo can, the cardboard made a mucky, farting sound in the mud as he bounced up and down. He wasn't kidding. For the next 4 days, we used his toothbrush to clean our weapons and mine on our teeth. It turned out we had a lot in common. Catholic high schools, sports, altar boys when we were little. Boy Scouts. Neither of us made Eagle. John had to cut back on everything except football to help his mother and sisters when his father was sick. I'd dropped out because with football and lacrosse, student council, a job in an auto body shop on weekends, and plenty of parties, something had to give. Camping out with a bunch of guys in uniforms on weekends came in low on my list of fun things to do, I said. John laughed. Guess you got over that. John's dad had been a Marine in World War II. After John decided to leave the seminary, enlisting seemed like the right thing to do. My dad had been on a cruiser during the battle for Okinawa. He didn't talk much about it, but always said the Marines were the bravest men he ever knew. I believed America was doing the right thing in Vietnam, fighting the spread of international communism, domino theory and all that. As a college freshman in 1968, I hated hearing classmates brag they'd get deferments until the war was over, or forever, whichever came first. My country was at war. Shouldn't I do my part? I stewed about that over Christmas vacation, though I didn't say anything to my parents. Back in Charlottesville in January, I bungled my way through exams. A week later, I dropped out and enlisted. I hitchhiked home to Townsend to tell Mom and Dad. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Mom yelled. A small woman, slim with dark brown hair, she came up out of her chair like a sparrow puffed up for a fight. You must be kidding me. Dad sat forward in his chair. No, Marty, you didn't. You're smarter than that. Tell me your father's right, Marty. You didn't, and this is not one damn bit funny. I picked up the burning cigarette Mom had dropped on the braided rug and handed it to her. No, Ma, I did. Don't ma me. She took a deep drag on the cigarette. I looked down at the new burn on the rug. I know you've both worked hard to send me to college. My good God, Mom said. But there's a war on. I thought you'd be proud. At least Dad would. I looked toward him for support. His eyes looked like he'd been stripped to be flogged. Can't you wait until you graduate? Then if you want to go into the service, you can do it as an officer. I already enlisted, Dad. I go to Paris Island on the 17th. Dad sagged as though the air had been sucked out of his slender frame. I was afraid you'd come home to tell us you got some girl in a family way. That would have been bad enough. But drop out of Virginia to go to Vietnam? He'd not gotten to go to college, had worked at Bethlehem Steel over 20 years.
There's a war on.
Mom sounded like she was mocking me.
And my only child wants to go fight it? Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
She walked out of the room fast. I supposed to go cry. Dad lit another cigarette and sat studying the floor as if something there might tell him how I, or maybe he, could have gone so wrong. They calmed down in a day or so, I told John. But it got pretty tense before I left. I don't know what was worse,
Mom yelling or crying or Dad looking like he might.
John laughed. You got off easy. Pasta Mama threw a bowl at me. She never calmed down. My sisters had to keep her from killing me before I could come here.
He looked serious for a minute.
What do we do to our mothers? He said.
John talked about life in the bush. Patrol formations, where the lieutenant wanted the gun teams for ambushes, assaults, interlocking defensive fires at night, and for when we searched vills.
Not much happening around here, he said.
No contact in days.
He sounded like he was being deprived.
We were almost finished cleaning the gun when John glanced around at the Marines on our side of the hill. It looked as though he were about to welcome me into his secret club.
You're gonna love these guys. The skipper calls First Platoon the frat house.
He bent over the M60 again and began to spread viscous, white, lubricating fluid across the feed pole.
Most educated infantry platoon in the Marine Corps, he says.
A year of college, sort of, for me.
Doc Matheson has 2 years, an associate's degree.
Corgan actually has his bachelor's. Geo named him the professor.
Now we get a semester from you.
These guys have balls, too.
Most of them.
Wasn't Corgan an officer?
He got his draft notice, so he enlisted in the Marines. They tried to get him to sign up for OCS, but he didn't want to do more than 2 years. Going to law school when he gets out. Figured he'd be safer with the Marines than going to war with a bunch of draftees. Smart man, the professor.
I couldn't tell if John meant that or not.
Of course, they're not all like that, he said. We've got plenty of guys my mother would say are from way across the wrong side of the tracks.
He cocked his head.
I guess there's tracks farther out than the ones we lived across.
John looked directly at me for a moment, then gazed away, a suddenly contemplative look on his face.
It's an interesting thing, he said, being in the bush, doing what we do.
He hesitated.
Or, maybe I should say, have done to us. You can lose your bearings if you're not careful.
The former seminarian seemed to be talking about a moral compass of some kind, but I wasn't sure what he meant. I waited for him to go on.
Sometimes it takes real courage to make the right choices out here. I'm not talking just physical courage. I mean not letting the darkness that can get inside you take over.
For a moment, John looked like he was studying some pattern in the mud to the side of the gun. It would be a long time before I truly understood what John was talking about. The choices you make at the margins. Some might even say at the far edges of sanity. And what I learned then has amazed me the rest of my life. An explosion suddenly erupted from the hill to our east. The noise rushing at us a sodden roar, as though sound waves had been wrenched from the mud and hurled through the thick air. I bolted upright, looked around frantically, then tried to hold absolutely still. Anxious, embarrassed, waiting for John to react. He gestured for me to hand him a belt of rounds from the top of another ammo can, slid the M60's bolt home, then wiped his lubricant, shiny fingers on his shorts.
Let's go see what's up.
I thought I saw concern in his eyes. A South Vietnamese army company had been encamped on the lower hill a quarter mile away until earlier that morning. Marines milled around behind 1st Platoon's sector of the line, staring toward the hill like they were waiting for a demolition derby's next blast of cars around the third turn. John put his hand on a man's shoulder. Virgil Landon turned around. He had a mouse face, round cheeks, bright brown eyes, a sharp nose, and oversized yellow front teeth. A wispy brown mustache curled down past his upper lip.
How you doing, Nat Nuts? John said. What's up?
Landon didn't say anything, just nodded and smiled as though he'd just been blessed. He'd never fired a rifle before boot camp, but was the best marksman in the platoon.
Shoot the nuts off a gnat from 500 yards in the offhand position, Ginelli claimed.
Landon rarely spoke. He seemed frightened of words, as though a teacher had ridiculed something he'd recited in class, and he'd been reluctant to speak ever since.
Holiness?
A scrawny kid held up his hand. John slapped him 5.
Que pasa, Rodolfo?
Booby trap, man. Gooners doing gooners. That's the best.
He did a sort of little jig.
Everything about him was purple. The granny glasses perched on his blade-thin nose,
the cheap stone and the silver ring on.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?